was that? Or that? Find out what's going on in this, the April issue of Look Here. Hello, I'm Stephen Buckley, listening out for the harbingers of spring. And to help me to do that, here in the studio are Barney Burnham.
Hello.
Evelyn Brock.
Hello.
And Christine Buckley.
Hello.
First, a personification of spring by poet Felicia Hemans, written around 1823. Evelyn.
I come, ye have called me long. I come o'er the mountains with light and song. Ye may trace my step o'er the waking earth by the winds which tell of the violet's birth, by the primrose stars in the shadowy grass, by the green leaves opening as I pass. I have breathed on the south, and the chestnut flowers by thousands have burst from the forest bowers. And the ancient graves and the fallen fanes are veiled with wreaths on Italian plains. But it is not for me, in my hour of bloom, to speak of the ruin or the tomb. I have looked o'er the hills of the stormy north, and the larch has hung all his tassels forth. The fisher is out on the sunny sea, and the reindeer bounds o'er the pastures free. And the pine has a fringe of softer green, and the moss looks bright where my step has been. I have sent through the woodpaths a glowing sigh, and called out each voice of the deep blue sky. From the night birds lay through the starry time, in the groves of the soft Hesperian clime, to the swan's wild note by the Iceland lakes, when the dark fir branch into verdure breaks. From the streams and founts I have loosed the chain. They are sweeping on to the silvery main. They are flashing down from the mountain brows. They are flinging spray o'er the forest boughs. They are bursting fresh from their sparry caves. And the earth resounds with the joy of waves.
The Voice of Spring by Felicia Dorothea Hemans. Hemans is probably better known for her poem Casabianca, which begins, you'll remember, "The boy stood on the burning deck," much parodied by many authors since, including Spike Milligan. Somewhat in Milligan's style is monologuist Billy Bennett, who here turns his whimsical pen on J. Milton Hayes's The Green Eye of the Little Yellow God. He calls it
"The Green Tie on the Little Yellow Dog." There's a little sallow idle man lives north of Waterloo, and he owns the toughest music hall in town. There are broken-hearted comics, there's a graveyard for them too, and the gallery gods are ever gazing down. He was known as Fat Carew in the pubs round Waterloo, and he wore a green tie with a diamond pin. He was worshipped in the ranks by the captain of the Swanks, and the coalman's daughter loved his double chin. He had loved her all along, and despite his on bon bon, the fact that she loved him, they say, was right. Though her complexion was a fake, and her teeth were put and take, put in by day and taken out by night. 'Twas the 15th anniversary of her 22nd year, so he smiled at her as sweetly as a hog, and asked what present she would like, and jestingly she said, "Your green tie for my little yellow dog." Fat Carew seemed in a trance, and his heart slipped through his pants. But he tried his utmost not to look a wreck. So he handed her the tie and kissed her hand goodbye, when he bowed his head, she bit his neck. Later on, Carew came too. His tie had gone, it's true, and his tie pin with it. He seemed in a fog. He rushed like mad to find that she'd tied that tie behind to the tailpiece of her little yellow dog. She was screaming like a child. The dog was running wild, biting policemen as he galloped up the straight. For the little dog called Tom, when he wagged his to and from, felt the tie pin urged him on to meet his fate. The dog returned at dawn with his windscreen slightly torn, and on seeing took something from the lady's room. To another room he flew, saying, "That's for Fat Carew," and silently he slunked out in the gloom. When Carew jumped into bed, he'd have wakened up the dead with a scream as he fell like a hog. Her false teeth, they were buried in the seat of Fat Carew. 'Twas the vengeance of that little yellow dog. There's a cock-eyed yellow poodle to the north of Gonga Pooch. There's a little hot cross bun that's turning green. There's a double-jointed woman doing tricks in Chuchin Chow. And you're a better man than I am, Gunga Din.
Billy Bennett's spoof on Hayes's Green Eye of the Little Yellow God. Had this been the 1st of April, we might have attempted to pass it off as the original. But the woman in our next item could never have done that. H.H. Munro, otherwise known as Saki, wrote this short piece, which is entitled The Woman Who Told the Truth. Christine.
There was once a woman who told the truth. Not all at once, of course, but the habit grew upon her gradually, like lichen on an apparently healthy tree. She had no children, otherwise it might have been different. It began with little things, for no particular reason, except that her life was a rather empty one, and it is so easy to slip into the habit of telling the truth in little matters. And then it became difficult to draw the line at more important things, until at last she took to telling the truth about her age. She said she was 42 and 5 months. By that time, you see, she was voracious even to months. It may have been pleasing to the angels, but her elder sister was not gratified. On the woman's birthday, instead of the opera tickets which she'd hoped for, her sister gave her a view of Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, which is not quite the same thing. The revenge of an older sister may be long in coming, but like a southeastern express, it arrives in its own good time. The friends of the woman tried to dissuade her from overindulgence in the practice, but she said she was wedded to the truth, whereupon it was remarked that it was scarcely logical to be so much together in public. No really provident woman lunches regularly with her husband if she wishes to burst upon him as a revelation at dinner. He must have time to forget, and an afternoon is not enough. And after a while, her friends began to thin out in patches. Her passion for the truth was not compatible with a large visiting list, for she told Miriam Klopstock exactly how she looked at the county ball. Certainly, Miriam had asked her for her candid opinion, but the woman prayed in church every Sunday for peace in our time, and it was not consistent. It was unfortunate, everyone agreed, that she had no family. With a child or two in the house, there is an unconscious check upon too free an indulgence in the truth. Children are given us to discourage our better emotions. That is why the stage, with all its efforts, can never be as artificial as life. Even in an Ibsen drama, one must reveal to the audience things that one would suppress before the children or the servants. Fate may have ordained the truth-telling from the commencement and should justly bear some of the blame. But in having no children, the woman was guilty, at least, of contributory negligence. Little by little, she felt she was becoming a slave to what had once been merely an idle propensity, and one day she knew. Every woman tells 90% of the truth to her dressmaker. The other 10% is the irreducible minimum of deception beyond which no self-respecting client trespasses. Madame Draga's establishment was a meeting ground for naked truths and overdressed fictions, and it was here the woman felt that she might make a final effort to recall the artless mendacity of past days. Madame herself was in an inspiring mood, with the air of a sphinx who knew all things and preferred to forget most of them. "If I take it in here and there, and round like this, so, I really think you will find it fits perfectly." The woman hesitated. It seemed to require such a small effort to simply acquiesce in Madame's views, but habit had become too strong. "I'm afraid," she faltered, "it's just the least little bit in the world too." And by that least little bit, she measured the deeps and eternities of her thraldom to fact. Madame was not best pleased at being contradicted on a professional matter, and where Madame lost her temper, you usually found it afterwards in the bill. And at last, the dreadful day dawned, as the woman had foreseen all along that it must. It was one of those paltry little truths with which she harried her waking hours. On a raw Wednesday morning, in a few ill-chosen words, she told the cook that she drank. She remembered the scene afterwards, as it was vividly implanted in her mind. The cook was a good cook, as cooks go, and as cooks go, she went. Miriam Copstock came to lunch the next day. Women and elephants never forget an injury.
Although many countries have their own versions of April Fool's Day, the origin of the custom remains a mystery. Some historians have linked it to festivals such as Hilaria, Latin for joyful, which was celebrated in ancient Rome at the end of March by followers of the cult of Cybele. It involved people dressing up in disguises and playing tricks on fellow citizens and even magistrates. Another theory has April Fool's Day originating in 16th century France, where the beginning of the new year was originally observed on April the 1st. After the introduction of the Gregorian calendar, New Year was moved to January the 1st, a change that was not universally popular. Those who adopted the new calendar played tricks on those who had not and referred to their victims as April Fools. In British folklore, April Fool's Day is associated with Gotham in Nottinghamshire and an event from the 13th century. According to legend, King John decided to acquire some of the land of Gotham for a hunting lodge. Naturally, this was not popular with the townsfolk, and so they decided on a cunning plan to dissuade the king. They decided to play the fool. So when the king's men arrived in the town, they found the townspeople doing all sorts of idiotic things, such as trying to drown fish. This was enough for the king's men to counsel the king to choose somewhere else for his lodge, as Gotham was obviously full of madmen. Ever since then, according to legend, April Fool's Day has commemorated their trickery. If so, you would expect to find references to April Fool's Day from then onwards, whereas the first reference wasn't until 1686, when the writer John Aubrey referred to the celebration of Fool's Holy Day. And on the 1st of April 1698, when the Tower of London housed a zoo, people were tricked into visiting the tower to see the lions washed. That august body, the BBC, has not been averse to getting in on the act. And on April the 1st, 1957, Richard Dimbleby, during an episode of Panorama, solemnly told the nation that spaghetti grew on trees and that there had been a bumper harvest in Switzerland. And in April 1965, the Beeb announced that they were about to conduct a trial of a new technology, allowing the transmission of odour over the airwaves to all viewers. This was to be called Smellovision. It's claimed that many viewers called in to congratulate the corporation on the success of the trial. In 1969, the public broadcaster NTS in the Netherlands announced that inspectors with remote scanners would be driving around to detect people who had not paid their TV licence. The only way to prevent detection was to wrap the TV in aluminium foil. The next day, the supermarkets were sold out of the stuff. Then, in 2008, the BBC was at it again. This time, they reported that during filming for their natural history series, Miracles of Evolution, they had captured footage of flying penguins. Presenter Terry Jones of Monty Python fame was shown walking with the penguins in Antarctica and then following their flight to the Amazon rainforest, where the penguins would spend the winter basking in the tropical sun. The video went viral on the internet. No April anthology would be complete without Robert Browning's poem, Home Thoughts from Abroad. Evelyn.
Oh, to be in England now that April's there, and whoever wakes in England sees, some morning, unaware, that the lowest boughs and the brushwood sheaf round the elm tree bole are in tiny leaf, while the chaffinch sings on the orchard bough in England now. And after April, when May follows and the whitethroat builds and all the swallows, hark, where my blossomed pear tree in the hedge leans to the field and scatters on the clover blossoms and dewdrops at the bent spray's edge. That's the wise thrush. He sings each song twice over, lest you should think he never could recapture the first fine, careless rapture. And though the fields look rough with hoary dew, all will be gay when noontide wakes anew the buttercups, the little children's dower, far brighter than this gaudy melon flower.
George Orwell had some thoughts of his own about spring. His were Thoughts on the Common Toad. Christine.
Before the swallow, before the daffodil, and not much later than the snowdrop, the common toad salutes the coming of the spring after his own fashion, which is to emerge from a hole in the ground where he has lain buried since the previous autumn and crawl as rapidly as possible towards the nearest suitable patch of water. Something, some kind of shuddering in the earth, or perhaps merely a rise of a few degrees in the temperature, has told him that it is time to wake up. Though a few toads appear to sleep the clock round and miss out a year from time to time. At any rate, I have more than once dug them up alive and apparently well in the middle of summer. At this period, after his long fast, the toad has a very spiritual look, like a strict Anglo-Catholic towards the end of Lent. His movements are languid but purposeful. His body is shrunken, and by contrast, his eyes look abnormally large. This allows one to notice, what one might not at another time, that a toad has about the most beautiful eye of any living creature. It is like gold, or more exactly, it is like the golden-coloured semi-precious stone which one sometimes sees in signet rings, and which I think is called a chrysoberyl. For a few days after getting into the water, the toad concentrates on building up his strength by eating small insects. Presently he is swollen to his normal size again, and then he goes through a phase of intense sexiness. All he knows, at least if he is a male toad, is he wants to get his arms around something. And if you offer him a stick, or even your finger, he will cling to it with surprising strength and take a long time to discover that it is not a female toad. Frequently, one comes upon shapeless masses of 10 or 20 toads rolling over and over in the water, one clinging to another without distinction of sex. By degrees, however, they sort themselves out into couples, with the male duly sitting on the female's back. You can now distinguish males from females, because the male is smaller, darker, and sits on top, with his arms tightly clasped around the female's neck. After a day or two, the spawn is laid in long strings which wind themselves in and out of the reeds and soon become invisible. A few more weeks, and the water is alive with masses of tiny tadpoles which rapidly grow larger, sprout hind legs, then forelegs, then shed their tails. And finally, about the middle of the summer, the new generation of toads, smaller than one's thumbnail, but perfect in every particular, crawl out of the water to begin the game anew. I mentioned the spawning of the toads because it is one of the phenomena of spring which most deeply appeals to me, and because the toad, unlike the skylark and the primrose, has never had much of a boost from poets. But I'm aware that many people do not like reptiles or amphibians, and I'm not suggesting that in order to enjoy the spring you have to take an interest in toads. There is also the crocus, the missel thrush, the cuckoo, the blackthorn, etc. The point is that the pleasures of spring are available to everybody and cost nothing. Even in the most sordid of streets, the coming of spring will register itself by some sign or other, if it is only a brighter blue between the chimney pots or the vivid green of an elder sprouting on a blitzed site. Indeed, it's remarkable how nature goes on existing unofficially, as it were, in the very heart of London. I've seen a kestrel flying over the Deptford gasworks, and I've heard a first-rate performance by a blackbird in the Euston Road. There must be some hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of birds living inside the four-mile radius, and it is rather a pleasing thought that none of them pays a halfpenny of rent. As for spring, not even the narrow and gloomy streets around the Bank of England are quite able to exclude it. It comes seeping in everywhere. The spring is commonly referred to as a miracle, and during the past 5 or 6 years, this worn-out figure of speech has taken on a new lease of life. After the sorts of winters we have had to endure recently, the spring does seem miraculous, because it has become gradually harder and harder to believe that it is actually going to happen. Is it wicked to take a pleasure in the spring and other seasonal changes? Or to put it more precisely, is it politically reprehensible while we are still all groaning, or at any rate ought to be groaning, under the shackles of the capitalist system, to point out that life is frequently more worth living because of a blackbird song, the yellow elm tree in October, or some other natural phenomenon which does not cost money and does not have what the editors of left-wing newspapers call a class angle? I think that by retaining one's childhood love of such things as trees, fishes, butterflies, and, to return to my first instance, toads, one makes a peaceful and decent future a little more probable, and that by preaching the doctrine that nothing is to be admired except steel and concrete, one merely makes it a little surer that human beings will have no outlet for their surplus energy except in hatred and leader worship. At any rate, spring is here, even in London N1, and they can't stop you enjoying it. This is a satisfying reflection. How many times have I stood watching the toads mating, or a pair of hares having a boxing match in the young corn, and thought of all the important persons who would stop me enjoying this if they could. But luckily, they can't. So as long as you are not actually ill, hungry, frightened, or immured in a prison or a holiday camp, spring is still spring. Atom bombs are piling up in the factories. The police are prowling the cities. The lies are streaming from the loudspeakers. But the earth is still going round the sun. And neither the dictators nor the bureaucrats, deeply as they disapprove of the process, are able to prevent it.
George Orwell's Thoughts on the Common Toad. We heard Billy Bennett's fantasy earlier on The Green Eye of the Little Yellow God. George Orwell's 1984 was the basis of a fantasy by Alan Corran, published in Harper's Magazine back in 1975, in which he sets out to prove that totalitarianism in Britain could never work. How could it, he asks, when nothing else does? Barney.
Owing to circumstances beyond our control, 1984 has been unavoidably detained. Winston Smith lay on his mean little bed in his mean little room and stared at his mean little telescreen. The screen stared back, blank. Smith eased himself from the side of his mean little blonde, walked across his dun and threadbare carpet, and kicked the silent cathode. A blip lurched unsteadily across it and disappeared. Smith sighed and picked up the telephone. "Would you get me Renter Brother Telly Hire?" he said.
"They're in the book," said the operator.
"I haven't got a book," said Smith. "They didn't deliver it."
"It's no good blaming me," said the operator. "It's a different department."
"I'm not blaming you," said Smith. "I just thought you might get me the number."
"I was just going off," said the operator, "on account of the snow."
"It's not snowing," said Smith.
"Not now it isn't," said the operator. "I never said it was snowing now."
"Perhaps I might have a word with the supervisor," said Smith.
"She's not here," said the operator. "She gets her hair done Fridays."
"I only need the Renter Brother number," said Smith. "Perhaps you could find it for me. You must have a book."
"I'd have to bend," said the operator.
"I'd be awfully grateful," said Smith.
"I've just done me nails."
"Please," said Smith. There was a long pause, during which a woman came on and began ordering chops, and someone gave Smith a snatch of the weather forecast from Heligoland. After that, there was a bit of recipe for sausage toad. Eventually, after two further disconnections, the operator came back.
"It's 706-544,
she snapped. 809-113, shouted a voice. "East Asian cat's home." He got a Samoan ironmonger after that, and then a French woman who broke down and screamed. At last, "Rent a brother telly hire," said a man. "Winston Smith here," said Smith. 72A Osbaldston Road. "I'm afraid my telly screen seems to be out of order."
"What am I supposed to do?" said the man. "We're up to our necks."
"But I'm not being watched," said Smith. "Big Brother is supposed to be monitoring me at all times."
"Ring Big Bleeding Brother then," said the man. "Maybe he's not suffering from staff shortages, seasonal holidays, people off sick. Maybe he's not awaiting deliveries. Not to mention we had a gull get in the stockroom. There's stuff all over, all the labels come off, broken glass, people ringing up all hours of the day and night. You realise this is my tea time?"
"I'm terribly sorry," said Smith. "It's just that..."
"Might be able to fit you in Thursday fortnight," said the man. "Can't promise nothing, though. Got a screwdriver, have you?"
"I'm not sure," said Smith.
"Expect bleeding miracles, some people," said the man, and rang off.
Smith put the phone down and was about to return to the bed when there was a heavy knocking on the door, and before he or the little blonde could move, it burst from its hinges and two enormous constables of the Thought Police hurtled into the room. They recovered, looked round and took out notebooks.
"Eric Jarvis," cried the larger of the two. "We have been monitoring your every action for the past 6 days, and we have reason to believe that the bicycle standing outside with the worn brake blocks is registered in your name."
"What have you to say?" "I'm not Eric Jarvis," said Smith. They stared at him.
"Here's a turn-up,"
said the shorter officer.
"Ask him if he's got any means of identity," murmured the larger.
"Have you any means of identity?"
said the constable. "I'm waiting for a new identity card," said Smith. "It's in the post."
"I knew he'd say that," said the larger officer.
"We're writing it now," said his colleague. "Think of the paperwork."
They put their notebooks away.
"You wouldn't know where this Eric Jarvis is, by any chance," said the taller.
I'm afraid not, said Smith. Who's that on the bed, then?
It's certainly not Eric Jarvis, said Smith. They all looked at the little blonde.
He's got us there, said the shorter constable.
I've just thought, said the taller. I don't think people are supposed to, do it, are they?
Do what?
You know, men. The thought policeman looked at his boots and, women.
I don't see what that's got to do with warm brake blocks, said his colleague.
They tipped their helmets. Mind, there you go, they said. Smith let them out and came back into the room. I'll just nip down to the corner, he said to the little blonde, and pick up an evening paper. Shan't be a tick. It was crowded on the street. It was actually the time of the 2 minutes hate, but half the public telly screens were conked out. And anyway, the population was largely drunk or arguing with one another or smacking kids around the head or running to get a bet on or dragging dogs from lampposts or otherwise preoccupied. So nobody paid much attention to the suspended telescreens, except for the youths throwing stones at them. Smith edged through and bought a newspaper and opened it.
Come off it, big brother, screamed the headline.
Above a story blaming the government for rising food prices, the shortage of underwear, and the poor showing of the Oceanic football team. It wasn't, Smith knew, the story the government hacks had given to the printers, but you could never get the printers to listen to anyone, and when challenged, they always blamed the shortage of type, claiming that they could only put the words together from the letters available, and who cared anyhow? The government, with so much on its plate, had given up bothering. It was as Winston Smith turned to go back to his flat that he felt a frantic plucking at his knee and heard a soprano scream ring through the street. He looked down and saw a tiny youth spy jumping up and down below him.
"Winston Smith, that's dirty things up in 14B!"
howled the child.
"Come and get him, he's got a nude lady up there!"
The youth spy might have elaborated on these themes, had his mother not reached out and given him a round-arm swipe that sent him flying into the gutter. But even so, the damage had been done, and before Smith had time to protest, he found himself picked up bodily by a brace of uniformed men and slung into the back of a truck, which, siren wailing, brought him rapidly through the evening streets towards the fearful pile of the Ministry of Love.
"Smith W.," barked the uniformed man to whom Smith was manacled, at the desk clerk.
"What's he done?"
said the clerk.
"I was just off home."
"They caught him at a bit of as your father," said Smith's captor.
"It's Friday night," said the desk clerk. "I'm going to bingo on Fridays."
He turned to Smith. "Don't let it happen again, lad. You can go blind."
"I've written in the book," said the guard. "It's no good saying go home. I'd have to tear the page out."
He put his free hand on Smith's arm.
"Sorry about this, son. It'd be different if I had a rubber. We're awaiting deliveries."
"You better take him up to room 101 then," said the clerk.
"Not room 101, screamed Smith. "Not the torture chamber, please. I never did anything. I hardly know the woman. Can't anyone help me? Don't send me up."
"Stop that," said the clerk sharply. "You'll start the dog off."
Smith was dragged, shrieking, to the lift.
"Ah, Smith, Winston," cried the white-coated man at the door of room 101. "Won't you come in? Rats, I believe, are what you fear most of all. Big brown rats, big brown pink-eyed rats."
"No," screamed Smith, "not rats, anything but rats, no, no, no."
"Rats with long, slithery tails," Smith, "fat, hungry rats, rats with sharp little..."
"Oh, do shut up, Edmund," interrupted his assistant wearily. "You know we haven't got any rats. We haven't seen a rat since last December's delivery."
"No rats," gasped Smith. Esmond sighed and shook his head. Then he suddenly brightened.
"We've got mice, though," he cried. "Big, fat, hungry, pink-eyed."
"I don't mind mice," said Smith. They looked at him.
"You're not making our job any easier, you know," muttered Esmond.
"Try him on toads," said Edmund's assistant. "Can't move in the stockroom for toads."
"That's it," exclaimed Esmond. "Toads, big, fat, slimy."
"I quite like toads," said Smith. There was a long pause.
"Spiders?"
"Lovely little things," said Smith. "If it's any help, I can't stand moths."
"Moths," cried Esmond. "Where do you think you are, bloody Harrods?
We can't get moths for love nor money. Comes in here, big as you please, asking for moths, said Edmund's assistant.
Smith thought for a while. I'm not all that keen on stoats, he said.
At last, said Edmund, I thought we'd be here all night. Give him a stoat, Dennis.
So they put Winston Smith in room 101 with a stoat. It was an old stoat, and it just sat on the floor, wheezing. And as far as Smith was concerned, things could have been, all things considered, a lot worse.
Alan Corran's not the only writer with a wry view of England. Bill Bryson is basically an American, hailing from Iowa, but he has lived in Britain for most of his life. In his book, The Road to Little Dribbling, in which he travels the length of the country, he describes his introduction to our small island. I first came to England when I was just 20. In those days, for a short but intensive period, a very high proportion of all in the world that was worth taking note of came out of Britain. The Beatles, James Bond, Mary Quant and Miniskirts, Twiggy and Justin de Villeneuve, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor's love life, Princess Margaret's love life, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, suit jackets without collars, television series like The Avengers and The Prisoner, spy novels by John le Carré and Len Deighton, Marianne Faithfull and Dusty Springfield, quirky movies starring David Hemmings and Terence Stamp that we didn't quite get in Iowa, Harold Pinter plays that we didn't get at all, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. That was the week that was, the Profumo scandal. Practically everything, really. Advertisements in magazines like The New Yorker and Esquire were full of British products in a way they never would be again. Gilby's and Tanqueray Gin, Harris Tweeds, BOAC Airliners, Aquascutum Suits, MG and Austin Healey Sports Cars, 100 varieties of Scotch whiskey. It was clear that if you wanted quality and suavity in your life, it was British goods that were in a large part going to supply it. Not all of this made a great deal of sense even then, it must be said. A popular cologne of the day was called Pub. I am not at all sure what resonances that was supposed to evoke. I have been drinking in England for 40 years, and I can't say that I have ever encountered anything in a pub that I would want to rub on my face. Because of all the attention we gave Britain, I thought I knew a fair amount about the place, but I quickly discovered upon arriving that I was very wrong. I couldn't even speak my own language there. In the first few days, I failed to distinguish between collar and colour, khaki and car keys, lettuce and lettuce, calmer and calmer. Needing a haircut, I ventured into a unisex hairdresser's in Oxford, where the proprietress, a large and vaguely forbidding woman, escorted me to a chair and there informed me crisply, "Your hair will be cut by a vet today." I was taken aback. "Like a person who treats sick animals," I said, quietly horrified. "Her name is Yvette," she replied, and with the briefest of gazes into my face, made it clear that I was the most exhausting idiot that she had encountered in some time. In a pub, I asked what kind of sandwiches they had. "Ham and cheese," the man said. "Oh, yes, please," I said. "Yes, please, what?" he said. "Yes, please, ham and cheese," I said, but with less confidence. "No, it's ham or cheese," he explained. "You don't do them both together?" "No." "Oh," I said, surprised. Then, leaning forward towards him and in a low, confidential tone, said, "Why not? Too flavorful?" He stared at me. "I'll have cheese then, please," I said contritely. When the sandwich came, the cheese was extravagantly shredded. I had never seen a dairy product distressed before serving, and accompanied by what I now know was Branston pickle, but what looked to me then like what you find when you stick your hand into a clogged pump. I nibbled it tentatively, and was pleased to discover that it was delicious. Gradually, it dawned on me that I had found a country that was wholly strange to me, and yet somehow marvellous. It is a feeling that has never left me. That was an excerpt from The Road to Little Dribbling, More Notes from a Small Island by Bill Bryson, who, for what it's worth, I am told, looks a little like me. Bryson's route from Bognor Regis on the south coast to Cape Roth in Scotland, despite its proximity to Worcester, did not take him across Powick Bridge, which, as you may know, is just a short distance from where we're sitting now. Well, if he'd tried today, he wouldn't have got across Powick Bridge anyway, on account of it having partly collapsed quite recently. You've probably heard. Powick and its bridge are famous for a skirmish that took place there in 1642, an encounter between Royalists and Roundheads, which marked the very start of the English Civil War. Evelyn.
After raising his royal standard at Nottingham on the 22nd of August and effectively declaring war against Parliament, King Charles I moved towards Shrewsbury in order to pick up armaments and fresh troops from areas sympathetic to his cause. Meanwhile, Sir John Byron had left Oxford with a large convoy of money and silver plate, donated by the university for the king's cause and bound for Worcester. As Parliament's newly raised 21,000-strong army marched from Northampton towards Worcester, its general, the Earl of Essex, sent an advance guard of around 1,000 Roundhead horse and dragoons under Colonel John Brown to intercept Byron's slow-moving convoy and capture its wealth. Aware that the parliamentarians were closing in, the king's nephew, Prince Rupert of the Rhine, took a detachment to protect the convoy. Rupert was the definition of the dashing cavalier stereotype: young, daring, handsome, courageous. He was to have a significant role to play in the war and in how the royalist cause would be viewed by history. At dawn on the 23rd of September, Colonel Brown's detachment took up position near Powick Bridge on the River Teme, south of Worcester, in order to attack Byron's convoy. Farcically, Brown did not know that Rupert's detachment was positioned just a couple of fields away, and when he sent Colonel Sands' cavalry regiment across Powick Bridge to occupy Wick Field at the end of the lane leading from the bridge, they were fired upon by dragoons that Rupert had ordered to line the hedges of that same lane. Sands rushed forward to get out of the ambush and into the open ground of Wick Field, unknowingly blundering straight into Rupert's main force. Rupert and his men charged. Sands was killed, and the parliamentarians were driven back down the lane. Although Brown's dragoons at Powick Bridge covered the retreat before withdrawing, many of the parliamentarian cavalry, taken by surprise and given fright, thought they were being pursued and did not stop retreating until they had reached Essex's main army many miles to the south. The silverware from Oxford had been saved and would bankroll the king in the early stages of the war. Powick was a major propaganda victory for the royalist cause, and it had a profound psychological effect on both sides. Prince Rupert's reputation among the common troops for being invincible was founded here and would not be finally shaken off until his defeat at Marston Moor in 1644. Plus, it also dealt a serious blow to the morale of the parliamentarian cavalry. By coincidence, the English Civil Wars ended at Worcester almost exactly 9 years later. on the 3rd of September 1651, Parliament's new model army under Oliver Cromwell crushed the Scottish engager army of Charles II, forcing the new king to flee to the continent and bring the wars to a close. After the battle, the radical preacher Hugh Peters gave a sermon in which he remarked that Worcester was where England's sorrows began and where they were happily ended.
One can't help but wonder if the ghosts of Colonel Sands and his men still patrol Powick Bridge. And has anyone yet written a ghost story about it? If M.R. James were still alive, he would be ideal for the job. Take, for example, this excerpt from James's short story, rather misleadingly entitled Rats. Barney.
It happened in Suffolk, near the coast, where stands an inn built around 1770, commanding a view of the sea to the front. To this inn came my acquaintance Mr. Thompson when he was a young man, on a fine April spring day from the University of Cambridge, desirous of solitude in tolerable quarters and time for reading. His days there were very tranquil and uneventful. Work all the morning, an afternoon perambulation of the countryside, a little more reading and writing in the evening, and then to bed. On one of his walks, his eye caught sight of a white object some 100 yards to the left of the road, and crossing to it, he found himself looking at a square block of white stone fashioned somewhat like the base of a pillar, with a square hole in the upper surface. In the bar that night, Thompson asked why the white stone was there on the common. "An old-fashioned thing, that is," said the landlord, Mr. Betts. "We was none of us alive when that was put there." "It stands pretty high," said Mr. Thompson. "I dare say a sea mark was on it some time back." "Ah, yes," Mr. Betts agreed, "but whatever there was, it's felt to bits this long time since." Not every day did Thompson take a country walk. One afternoon found him still busily writing at 3 o'clock. Then he stretched himself and rose and walked out into the passage. At the south end of the passage was a window to which he went, considering that it was rather a shame to waste such a fine afternoon. However, work was paramount just at the moment, so he thought he'd take 5 minutes off, and these he would employ in looking into the other rooms in the passage, which he had never seen. The room facing his own was undistinguished, except for a print of Bury St. Edmunds. The two next to him were gay and clean. There remained the southwest room, but this was locked. However, Thompson was in a mood of quite indefensible curiosity. He fetched the keys from the three other rooms, one of them fitted, and he opened the door. The sun shone brightly into the room, and it was hot as it could be. The only furniture was an iron bedstead, with mattress and bolster covered with a counterpane. As featureless a room as you can well imagine. And yet there was something that made Thompson close the door very quickly and quietly behind him and lean against the wall in the passage, actually quivering all over. It was this, that under the counterpane someone lay, and not only lay, but stirred. That it was someone and not something was certain, because the shape of a head was unmistakable on the bolster. And yet it was all covered. And no one lies with covered head, but a dead person. And this was not dead, not truly dead, for it heaved and shivered. If he had seen these things in dusk or by the light of a flickering candle, Thompson could have comforted himself and talked a fancy. On this bright day, that was impossible. What was to be done? First, lock the door at all costs. But as with a rather tremulous hand he put the key into its hole, it rattled, and on the instant a stumbling, padding tread was heard coming towards the door. Thompson fled like a rabbit to his room and locked himself in. Futile enough, though he knew it was, would doors and locks be any obstacle to what he suspected? but it was all he could think of, and in fact, nothing happened. The impulse, of course, was to slip away as soon as possible. But only the day before he'd said he should be staying for at least another week. And how, if he changed plans, could he avoid the suspicion of having pried into places where he certainly had no business? On the whole, the line of least resistance was to stay. Well, he stayed out his week. Nothing took him past that door, and no sound whatever issued from that direction. As the end of his stay drew near, he yearned for some kind of explanation. He began planning some way of getting another daylight glimpse into that room, and eventually arrived at this scheme. He would leave by an afternoon train, and when his fly was waiting and his luggage on it, he would take one last look upstairs as if to see if anything was left unpacked, and then the door should once more be opened for a moment and shut. So it worked out. The bill was paid, the consequent small talk gone through while the fly was being loaded, and then, "I'll just take a look upstairs in case I've left a book out or something. No, no, don't trouble, I'll be back in a minute." And as noiselessly as possible, he stole to the door and opened it. The shattering of the illusion. He almost laughed aloud. Propped, or you might say sitting on the edge of the bed, was nothing but a scarecrow. A scarecrow out of the garden, of course, dumped into the deserted room. But now amusement suddenly ceased. Have scarecrows bare, bony feet? Do their heads loll onto their shoulders? Have they iron collars and links of chain about their necks? Can they get up and move across the floor with wagging head and arms close at their sides and shiver? The slam of the door, the dash to the stairhead, the leap downstairs were followed by a faint. Awakening, Thompson saw Betts standing over him with a brandy bottle and a very reproachful face. "You shouldn't have done so, sir. You really shouldn't. It ain't a kind way to act by persons as done the best they could for you." Mr. Betts, and perhaps even more Mrs. Betts, found it hard to accept his apologies and his assurance that he would say no word that could damage the good name of the house. However, they were accepted. And before he went, the Bettses told him what little they knew. "They says he was landlord here a long time back and was in with the highwayman that had their beat up on the heath. That's how he come by his end. Hung in chains, they say, up where you see that stone where the gallows stood in. We had the account from the people that had the house before we come. You keep that room shut up, they says, and don't move the bed out, and you'll find there won't be no trouble. And no more there has been. Not once he hasn't come out into the house, though what he may do now there ain't no saying. Anyway, you're the first I know that's seen him since we've been here, and I do hope, sir, as you'll keep a close tongue, considering our house do get talked about."
Mr. Thompson, in that story, took to walking for his exercise. Jogging for pleasure was rather less popular than it is today, although even the Victorians had had a growing obsession in fitness as a healthy pastime. Christine.
According to James Stark, writing in The Conversation, the Victorian fitness craze might first be traced back to the publication of Donald Walker's book British Manly Exercises in 1837. The book included diagrams showing a proper rowing technique, horse riding instructions, and detailed guidance on how to lunge, vault, and wrestle. Walker also included exercises borrowed from different cultures, such as strength training using clubs from India, which offered the most effectual kinds of athletic training known anywhere, according to a British officer stationed in the country. These forms of exercise quickly became popular, often because they were adopted by the British military. Achieving physical fitness gradually became a cornerstone of Victorian values. This was largely inspired by cultural trends such as muscular Christianity, which originated in England in the mid-19th century. Muscular Christianity emphasised the importance of training the body to reflect devotion to both God and society. One author claimed that strong Christian bodies could be used to protect the weak, advance all righteous causes, and promote the subduing of the earth which God has given to the children of men. Although hobbies such as riding horses and playing golf remained popular with the upper classes, exercise done at home became increasingly favoured by the emerging Victorian middle class. The portable gymnasium became a bestseller after it was published in 1861. It claimed there were numerous benefits to undertaking what the author called gymnastic exercises, which were said to develop and restore the human form. Some of these exercises look similar to what we do today. Readers were instructed to use the portable gymnasium to perform body toning exercises such as lateral extensions and head rotations. Exercise had grown so popular that by 1865 the Royal Patent Gymnasium, a huge outdoor gym, was opened in Edinburgh. It regularly attracted thousands of fitness fanatics each day. It featured the giant sea serpent, an enormous circular rowing machine which could reportedly seat 600 people at a time. By the late 19th century, James Cantley, a Scottish medical practitioner, had developed new exercise regimes that could be done at home. These included an elaborate routine of stretches to be performed morning and evening, accompanied by bathing and muscle massage. Cantley argued that they were especially suitable for the over 50s, as they did not cause too much exertion. He also founded the British Institute of Physical Training in 1889, where men and women, young and old, could attend exercise classes where they would practice Cantley's so-called physical jerks, rhythmic movements to strengthen and tone the body. People who came to the classes were encouraged to practice the exercises at home on a daily basis, but were simultaneously warned they needed to return regularly to learn new exercises and ensure they were using the correct techniques. Cantley also made other lifestyle recommendations, such as insisting that wearing kilts promoted the health and strength of lads, as they didn't restrict the body's natural movements. Other popular approaches to fitness and health included a regime developed by one Dr. E.H. Ruddock, whose book Vitalogy, 1899, promoted good posture, vitativeness, love for life, and only moderate exercise to avoid overtiring the body. After a series of military setbacks, Britain was gripped by a sense of anxiety by the end of the Victorian era about its place in the world. Many worried that industrialisation, which had driven the expansion of the British Empire, had made bodies weak. British people feared that they had become trapped indoors in factories and offices, made slovenly by technological change. Worry about national fitness persisted into the early 20th century, and the exercise craze showed no signs of stopping. For many middle and upper class Victorians, having a healthy body was an expression of religious and national devotion. Being able to achieve it in the comfort of the home was a bonus. The Victorian obsession with celebrating athletic prowess and striving to better their bodies physically is not unlike society's obsession with fitness today.
It's a sad fact that, as Dr. Jabin Begum reported, people with a disability such as visual impairment are less likely to be physically active, on account of which partially sighted or blind people have a 50% greater risk of chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease due to inactivity. Here's Evelyn with Dr. Begum's report.
From a young age, people with disabilities are deterred from physical activity.
Everyone needs physical activity, though, and a visual impairment shouldn't prevent you from living a healthy life. Many barriers prevent people with vision impairments from exercising. Sometimes the barrier is that they aren't taught to be physically active as a child and are instead omitted from physical activities because of their disability. Anyone, regardless of disability, can struggle to be active because of a lack of time, energy, and motivation. Common barriers for people with a visual impairment also include inadequate transportation, fear of injury, lack of helpful resources, and difficulty in learning new activities. Some people with a visual impairment can be active, just like someone with sight. But most should take some precautions to ensure their safety. For example, talk to your doctor before jumping into new exercises. Straining, sun exposure, lifting, and other aspects of exercising may adversely affect your health. Plan out what your goals are for exercising. Do you want to lose weight, build muscle, or be healthier? These goals will help narrow your search for an exercise routine. Exercise with a friend. A workout buddy can help hold you accountable and achieve your exercise goals. They can also be a safety guide as you start. And find an instructor. Talk with local trainers at your gym. They can work with you individually to create a safe exercise program for your goals. Once you've decided on your goals, you can narrow down the type of exercise you want to do. Cardiovascular exercises. There are various low-impact aerobic exercises to fit your capabilities and needs. Walking or running, on a track or treadmill, riding a stationary bike, body weight exercises like squats, planks, and push-ups. Stationary bikes and treadmills are popular suggestions for people with visual impairments, as a stationary frame provides parameters you can work within and get used to. But it's best if you start slowly to get accustomed to the movements of the treadmill. So it's essential that the machines have accessibility options for you to control the intensity of the exercise. A trainer or a workout buddy can also help enormously. Lightweight dumbbells, resistance bands, and medicine balls, either at home or in the gym, can help you build and tone your muscles and to improve your balance and flexibility. Tai Chi and yoga are great forms of exercise, which also build muscle and relax your body. One aspect of fitness that many people with sight have always taken advantage of is being able to watch an instructor for guidance. Many workout videos, yoga routines, and fitness apps rely on you being able to watch the forms and positioning. However, as awareness about fitness for people with disabilities grows, so do resources, and these days several apps and websites are designed around fitness for people with visual impairments. For example, some websites create detailed guides to workout routines. They explicitly describe each workout pose through audio or text files, so anyone with a visual impairment can use it. So, why not give it a try? Fitness can be satisfying, enjoyable, and fun
for everybody.
And if you fancy something less strenuous that nevertheless gets you out in the fresh air, try a spot of gardening.
OK, Mike, what have you got for us today?
Well, we're in April, so first of all, lawns.
Lawns.
Let's talk about the space we're sat in now. There's not too much moss, but I still recommend just scarifying it.
Yes.
And a scarifier is like a rake.
Yes.
Like a wire rake, which spins round very, very quickly.
Lots of fingers.
Yeah. And then that pulls out all the thatch and all the moss.
What is thatch?
Thatch is the thick bit around the roots of the grass.
Okay, so is it dead?
Deadish stuff.
Okay.
That thatch, as they call it, holds a lot of moisture.
Mm-hmm.
Scratch all that out, and then it allows air then to circulate around the grass roots.
Yes.
Which then makes
the grass stronger.
The grass stronger.
Yeah.
That's probably the first thing to do. And then you can always look at top seeding.
Mm-hmm.
Get some decent topsoil or loam, which is silt sand, and you could put that over the lawn and brush it in,
mm-hmm.
and that will take out the hollows and level the area, and then you could just put your seed over the top.
Mm.
Yes.
When's a good time to do the first cut?
The first cut, any time from now onwards, so end of March through to sort of the middle of May, is an ideal time to start cutting it. When you do your first cut, I'd make sure you cut slightly higher than you normally would, and then over time, then you can start bringing the grass down. And then next month in May, we have no mow May.
No mow May. Yeah.
Where we can just forget
yeah,
about the lawn.
I've done that before.
To try to encourage plants to come through for our wildlife to
yes.
thrive
yeah.
at that time of the year.
Yes, I'd forgotten no mow May.
Seeds now. Let's start that veg off.
Yes, I've got some tomato seeds
Excellent.
That are germinated.
Yes.
With tomato seeds, and probably other things as well, when they germinate, they get really leggy.
Yes.
Is that because they're looking for the light?
Yes, they are. Yes.
So what do I do?
Yeah, quite often you do see that. There's people who will have lots of plants on their windowsill,
mm.
and they will be quite leggy.
Yeah.
So possibly move them around the house and put them in different windowsills, or possibly spread them out on the shelf in the greenhouse.
Yeah.
That's something else. Mulching, if you've got raised beds, mulching is a really good time now
okay.
to just dig it in, basically. And the same with the flower beds as well.
Yeah, around the plants.
Around the plants. Any sort of mulch is good. There's some great stuff from the local tips in Worcester.
Okay, yeah.
This soil conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
It's all organic stuff. It's incredibly cheap. And it's also... It's also very, very good to put on the grass as a feed.
Yeah.
As the summer goes, there are some organic ways in feeding the lawns by just not collecting the clippings.
I was going to say to you about that, actually. What is your feeling about when you've mown the lawn? What do you do with all the cuttings?
The first few cuts, because the grass is going to be growing quickly, I'd make sure you remove everything. Remove it.
Yeah.
If you want to, you could use those clippings to spread around your flower beds to stop the weeds coming through. Because it will naturally over time break down. It does take a lot longer than, say, leaf mulch and various other things, but it will naturally break
I've
down.
I've always avoided doing that because I think, putting grass on the borders, am I going to end up with grass
with
growing?
Grass growing. No, you won't because you've already cut it.
The
only thing you may end up is if, say, you've caught some weeds or something like that,
some
seeds.
Yeah,
But then, if you are going to use the clippings back onto the lawn,
so
it may be
it
worthwhile
around.
Just spreading it around,
mm.
so it breaks down evenly.
Yeah.
As we get through April, the patios may want a bit of a pressure wash.
We've found an area that's really slippery.
Okay.
And I think with all the rain that we've had, it's sort of like made it worse. I don't know.
Yeah, I had a. This is an old wives' tale, so to speak, but I spoke to someone the other day and they said the best bet for killing off moss and also algae is actually soap powder.
Yes, a bio.
Soap powder.
And you sprinkle it on.
Sprinkle it on and just leave it on for 24 hours or until it rains. And then eventually it will kill off the moss or the algae.
I will give it a go and I'll let you know how we get on.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
That sounds good. I like that.
Yeah.
Houseplants.
Yes, now's the time to start feeding.
Start feeding houseplants.
Yes.
Yeah.
maybe wiping down the big leaves.
Yes,
because they get dusty.
They get dust on them, don't they?
Is it better to water houseplants from underneath
from the
in
base.
General?
Yeah.
Does that stop those little flies coming?
I mean, I would quite often this time of the year just take my houseplants, put them in the bath, and then just leave them there for half an hour just to soak the bottom. So they've got some water. And then just spend a bit of time just tidying them up.
Yeah.
And cutting them.
Some plants quite like a spray, and I've actually put them in the shower on cold, obviously.
Yeah.
I have just showered them down and then just leave them to drip off a bit.
Yeah, certain plants look just like the mist as well.
Yeah.
So we'll probably get together next time in June.
Jolly
There's
good.
An important date which I always have to mention, which is the 20th of May, which is World Bee Day. Please support the bee.
I shall.
Great.
I think it's time for a cup of tea.
Definitely, always time for a cup of tea.
All right then, Mike.
Vanya Carlton with Mike Lane there. While we're on the subject of gardening, Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote this poem back in 1917. Christine.
Hard seeds of hate I planted that should by now be grown. Rough stalks, and from thick stamens a poisonous pollen blown, and odours rank, unbreathable, from dark corollas thrown. At dawn from my damp garden I shook the chilly dew, the thin boughs locked behind me that sprang to let me through. The blossoms slept. I sought a place where nothing lovely grew. And there, when day was breaking, I knelt and looked around. The light was near, the silence was palpitant with sound. I drew my hate from out my breast and thrust it in the ground. Oh, ye so fiercely tended, ye little seeds of hate, I bent above your growing early and noon and late. Yet are ye drooped and pitiful. I cannot rear ye straight. The sun seeks out my garden. No nook is left in shade. No mist or mould nor mildew endures on any blade. Sweet rain slants under every bough. Ye falter and ye fade.
Blight by Edna St. Vincent Millay. Blight is not the only threat to plant life. Remember this? Well, if you didn't recognise it at the beginning of the magazine, I'll tell you now, it's a hippopotamus, a blight on the lives of the farmers of Tanzania and Kenya, who rate them second only to elephants in the amount of damage they can do when raiding their rice or maize crops. Hippos are also the deadliest land mammals on the planet, more deadly than sharks or lions. But if you hear that particular sound uncomfortably close, you perhaps don't need to be too scared, as that is its mating call, and so it's probably not you that he's interested in. Unless, that is, you're threatening to pinch his girlfriend. So, as it's now officially spring, the time when not just a young hippo's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of love, here are five more mating calls for you to guess. Which animal's mating call is this? Or this one? How about this? Or this? I'll give you the answers in a few minutes. Here's one more mating call to finish. A cry from the heart, if ever I heard one. Here's more on mating cries from Thomas White, writing in The Conversation in 2022. Barney.
Reproduction is the ultimate goal in life for most animals, but securing a mate is hard work. You must not only find a potential suitor, but hold their attention, identify yourself, and advertise your quality. To achieve this, animals use sexual signals. These conspicuous displays or ornaments help beat out the competition in the contest for mates. And some of the most beautiful aspects of the animal world have evolved for this purpose. Sexual signals are costly, though, and not just in terms of the energy it takes to sing or dance. One seemingly obvious and profound cost is predation. The idea is simple. Just as your private phone call may be overheard by nosy passers-by, so too may the bright colours and loud calls of sexual displays catch the eyes and ears of predators seeking a meal. Biologists describe the illicit interception of sexual signals as eavesdropping, and it's been formally studied since at least Charles Darwin. The Tungara frogs of Central and South America are a classic example. Their loud mating calls attract the unwanted attention of parasitic flies in search of a blood meal. Communicating with mates does increase the risk of being predated. Animals bearing sexual signals are roughly 5 times more likely to be attacked than those that are not actively signalling. The risk of being eaten depends on how the animals are communicating with each other. Those that use calls or pheromones to attract mates are in far greater danger than those using visual displays, which surprisingly experience no increased risk at all. The dangers of booming calls or strong pheromones are intuitive enough, but why do bold colours not raise the risk of being eaten? We suspect that there are 2 related reasons. One is that most predators are fussy eaters. Even those with broad diets, such as insect-eating birds and lizards, prefer to eat familiar prey and only rarely try new things. Since most animals present their sexual displays intermittently, colourful ornaments may be unfamiliar to predators, who will then avoid them out of caution. The other possible reason is that many animals use vivid colours as warning signals. Consider the striking black and red abdomens of redback spiders, which advertise the fact that they are dangerous and well defended. Predators may be generally wary of conspicuous patterns, then, since the animals bearing them are often more trouble than they're worth. So what do these results tell us about the evolution of communication? For one, we might expect visual displays to be more conspicuous and elaborate than other types of signal, such as calls or pheromones, given predators pose little threat in the face of extravagance. And in populations where predation is a persistent threat, we should expect to find that adaptive evolution favours the use of less risky signals, such as colour or motion, or the abandonment of signalling altogether. We can see this take place among the Pacific field crickets of Hawaii, where males have lost the ability to sing in response to intense predation by parasitic flies. Predators aren't the only ones interested in eavesdropping on prey. Humans are too. Pests such as locusts and aphids are not only a nuisance in our gardens, but also wreak havoc on crops. Enterprising researchers have shown we can hijack the sexual signals of these pests to combat them in 2 ways. One is by using their signals to attract and trap the pests themselves, as in the case of artificial acoustic signals mimicking mosquitoes and locusts. Or we can tap into the existing interests of predators to lure them towards pests in greater numbers. This has proven effective in managing aphids, for example, where we now commercially synthesise the sex pheromones of females. This attracts predatory wasps, which lay their eggs inside the aphids and ultimately kill them. It just shows that while attracting mates can be a dangerous game, it depends entirely on how you play.
Can't help thinking that kind of deception is a little unfair. Our audio playhouse this month looks at how a well-intended deception can benefit everyone. We present How White the Lie by John Stanbury.
Buddy, You off, love?
Yes, Daddy. I shan't be late.
You can be as late as you want, sweetheart. I shan't wait up. It's a big night. Just you make sure that you and that young man of yours have a good time, do you hear?
It's only a film, Daddy. Now, have you got everything you need?
Yes, of course I can.
I put the new loaf in the bread bin and there are two eggs in the fridge.
Yes, I know.
I put enough water in the saucepan,
Thank
Daddy.
You, sweetheart. Now you get off.
You're sure you'll be all right? I'll have my mobile on in case you need.
Now, that won't go down too well if I ring in the middle of the premiere, will it?
Oh, there's Bobby now.
Right, love. You have a good time now, remember?
We will, Daddy.
And good luck for tonight.
Thanks. It'll be fine. Oh, there's still some strawberry jam left
Off
in the pantry.
You go, Fidelia, or you'll miss the start.
Bye, Daddy.
Bye, love.
Hi.
Hi. Ready?
I can boil an egg, you know.
What I don't understand is why the bloke in the grey suit adopted the woman's puppy.
That was in a flashback.
And it grew into the big dog, and they thought it had
chased the chickens.
Yes, I know, but why did he adopt it in the first place?
I don't know. Perhaps he just wanted some company. Perhaps you should have asked the writers. They were sitting just in front of you.
Perhaps I should. Anyway, I thought you were brilliant in it.
Well, that's very kind
Even
of you.
Even though you've no idea what the story was about. I hope Dad's okay.
Oh, yeah, of course he is. Why shouldn't he be?
Yes, yes, I'm sure you're right. I left his tea ready. He's probably in bed by now.
I think you worry about him far more than he worries about you.
Oh, absolutely, yes. He wants me to leave home and settle down somewhere.
Ah, yes. Actually, I was wondering about our...
But he knows I won't leave him on his own. And we can't afford someone to go in and do for him.
Would your sister not help?
Diana?
You could sort of share the responsibility.
In Portugal?
Oh, is she in Portugal?
Robert Kelpie, I told you over a year ago she left the country for a new life in the sun.
Sorry, I forgot.
And she's got a bloke over there now, anyway. Someone dark and handsome, she tells me, with a bushy black moustache.
Hmm.
No, she won't be coming back here anytime soon. Ever since Mum died, looking after Dad has been down to little old me. Anyway, Diana doesn't really get on with him, you know that.
Yeah, you said... I don't suppose her having a Portuguese boyfriend has anything to do with it.
Oh, you remember that then?
How could I forget? When they thrashed Luxembourg last year, I thought he was going to have an heart attack. He was that upset. What's he got against Portugal? Is he a Luxembourg supporter?
No, of course not. It's got nothing to do with football. I'll tell you one day.
Oh, brilliant.
What is it?
I got it.
You got what?
It's me agent. He put me up for the new Bond movie.
Oh. And?
Vodka martini. Shaken, not stirred.
You don't mean... Robert, that's amazing. That's incredible. That's fantastic. That's wonderful.
Steady on.
Yeah, but James Bond. Wait till I tell the girls. My Robert, the new James
Hold
Bond.
Hold on, Fido. I'm not the new James Bond.
But you said...
No, but I am in it. Well, going to be. I'm one of the baddies.
The baddies? Well, that's good, isn't it?
I should say. 4 months' work on and off. Feature film rates. Starting in March, supposedly.
4 months?
More or less. Eventually, I jump out of an helicopter into a volcano or something.
Isn't that awfully dangerous?
Well, it won't actually be me. They have stunt people for that.
Stunt people?
Yeah, on twice my salary, probably.
But a James Bond movie. What's it called?
I'm sorry, I can't tell you that.
No, of course. It'll be frightfully hush-hush. Have you been sworn to secrecy?
No. They just haven't told me.
But the money's good.
Oh, the money is incredible.
Oh, wow. Clever, Bobby.
Your Robert's a talented guy and no mistake, Fidelia. On the up, I'd say. Good husband material, if ever I saw
it. Daddy, stop it. I'm not going to leave you. I couldn't.
Your mum wouldn't mind. She'd be all for it.
Well, it's not her worry now, is it?
I could get one of those retirement flats. Sheltered, they call it, don't they? I'd be all right in one of those.
Daddy, we've been through this a dozen times. We can't afford it, and you know it. Your pension's nowhere near enough to pay for a place like that. And the money from the shop, well, it's hardly enough to keep us both alive as it is.
I suppose you're right, love. But you don't want to be living with your old dad the rest of your life.
Yes, I do.
You're my daddy, and I love you, and I won't leave you here on your own, and that's an end to it.
But you...
Now, Robert will be here in a minute, and those potatoes need to be strained. Robert, love, have some more crumble.
Really? Well, I've had settings already, but...
Go ahead, lad. You'll need the energy jumping out of helicopters and all.
I already told Fidelia they'll use somebody else for that. But it doesn't mean I won't have just a little more crumble, if I may.
Good man. My daughter's the best cook for miles around.
Oh, Daddy, don't be silly.
No, I mean it. You couldn't do better, you know. Robert, lad, when are you going to take her off my hands?
Daddy!
When did you last have a holiday, girl?
I don't need a holiday. I'm perfectly happy.
You should be living in a home of your own with a garden, a dog and a husband.
Daddy, please.
Go on, lad. Why not? Don't you want her?
Robert, don't listen to him. Since your illness, you need someone to look after you. You know that, Dad. And we simply can't afford...
Well, I might be able to help here, you know.
What do you mean?
Well, I've been doing pretty well recently. I had that dog food advert and the one for the insurance company. Then the play in Leeds and last year's panto that went on for nearly 3 months. Then there was the film that premiered the other night. I've got a bit put by, you know. My granddad saw to that. He wanted to buy me a house. And now this bond thing next year, well, that shall pay loads. If it's money that's the problem.
Huh.
I'm sure we can...
Robert?
...sort something out.
No.
Mr. Noble, I really think
Robert,
we could find a way...
I said no. I know you mean well, lad, but no. Thank you very much. We can do this ourselves. Now, finish up your crumble and... I'm sorry. I'm off to bed. Good night to you. Good night to you both.
Night. Do you want a coffee?
Why won't he listen? I really could help with the money thing.
It's not really about the money.
Well, what then?
My dad's always worked hard for us. When I was a child, we were what people called comfortable, you know. Dad ran his own business. It was hard work, but he kept us safe and warm. Mum, Diana and me. He was very proud of that. Then in the 70s, after Vietnam, there were appeals for foreign aid to help the civilians rebuild their lives.
Uh-huh.
Dad's business was approached and... Oh, he's such a pushover, my dad. Just can't resist helping people in need. Some Portuguese businessman got him to lend money to a Cambodian construction company. Rebuilding the country for the future, he said. The money was guaranteed to be returned in full when the economy recovered. Dad reckoned it was all kosher, but he never got a penny back.
A Portuguese guy. I'm beginning to understand.
He was hoping to retire, see, even then. But this shark took most of his savings, so he had to keep the shop going. Until he had the stroke. It's been difficult for him, Robert. He's a proud man. Stubborn, not used to needing help, let alone accepting it.
And us?
While my dad's alive, I can't... You do understand, don't you?
Taxi for Mr. Kelpie.
Coming down.
How long's the flight?
About 4 hours, I think.
Send me a text when you arrive.
Of course. Oh, I wish you could come with me.
So do I. Anyway, toothbrush, shaver, passport?
It's only a few days filming. I'll be back before you know it.
Passport?
Yeah, here.
Then you'd better be off. Give my regards to Hollywood.
Lanzarote. I'd need a visa for Hollywood.
I knew that. Ring me on Thursday?
I'll see you in a week.
Yeah. See you.
Exciting news for fans of James Bond.
Background action.
When the next movie in the franchise, starring Hugh Grant,
Fidelia,
and Dench, started
what,
filming today.
It's that film, your Robert's film.
Of Lanzarote,
the Bond.
Canary Island. Some familiar faces, along with over 150 extras and crew, were flown in to shoot some key scenes in the movie.
Cut.
You are watching the lunchtime news on WTN.
Did you see him?
A look at last Ooh. Night's sports.
Robert.
No, it was very short.
He's not wrong.
Well, I expect he's busy. It's a big thing. He'll ring tonight, you'll see.
Yes, I expect so. I'll get it.
20 minutes later, Worcester scored again from a penalty after teenager Phil Lee succumbed.
Dad, you've got a visitor.
Senor Noble?
Yes. Who are you?
My name is Diego. May we talk privately?
Shall I go and make some tea?
Thank you, Miss Noble. That would be very nice.
What can I do for you, Mr...
Diego, please. We haven't met, but I know your daughter, Diana.
How exactly?
Diana and I met in Lisbon some 18 months ago. We have become very close, senor.
So you'll be Diana's Portuguese...
Sim, senor.
I don't think we have very much to say to one another, mister.
Por favor, senor. Listen to what I have to tell you. Please.
Go on, then.
Diana has told me much about her family, her sister, her mother, yourself. Diana, she is at home in Lisbon. She does not know that I have come here, but I have discovered something about her family's past which I felt I had to come.
Can you get to the point, Mr...
There is money owing, Mr. Noble, between us. Money which my father...
Your father? Are we talking about De Santa Rito?
Sim, senor.
If that man is trying to get another penny from me, I shall have the police on to you both. I've a good mind...
No, no, senor. You do not understand. My father is a good man.
A good man?
Sim, senor. Truly. But circumstances gathered around him, so he was not able to do everything that he wanted to.
Meaning?
I understand you lent my father some money.
I lent your father a lot of money.
Sim, senor. And he invested it, as he had promised to many people in repairing the damage done to Vietnam during the war. But it was more than 10 years before those investments began to have any effect on the country. Then, in 1993, my father was working in a village in Komplong when a small earthquake hit. 5 people were killed. My father was one of them. Most of his records of benefactors were lost. The investments lived on, of course, and as the country strengthened economically, so did they. It was in talking to your daughter that I realized that you yourself had contributed. Mr. Noble, I have to tell you that the money you gave my father has multiplied 200-fold or more.
So? What?
I calculate that my father, I owe you a substantial sum.
You owe... What do you mean, substantial?
I have with me a cheque payable to you for 293,000 euros.
Is this another con?
Signor, it is no con, as you put it. Here is the cheque. It is from Banco Santander. It is made out to you. You can cash it in any bank in this country. 293,000 euros is about 250,000 English pounds.
No, no, I can't accept it. I don't rely on charity, mister.
But, senor, it is your money. It is not a gift. It is not charity. It is yours. I am only the courier. It is your money. Here, take it.
I've brought a few scones as well.
And now I must be going.
Oh, but Mr...
I am sorry, Miss Noble, but I have to leave now. I have a plane to catch
Mr.
in less than...
Mr... De Santo, I don't know what to say. Thank you.
No need to thank me, senor. It is my duty, in memory of my own father. He kept his promise, senor. I don't want you to think ill of us.
Think ill of you? Never crossed my mind.
Well, passengers recently arrived on flight BY7195 from Lanzarote who have not yet...
Robert! Robert!
Fido!
It's good to see you.
How was it?
Oh, it was great. I was only in a couple of scenes. I had a few lines, but it was mostly just meaningful looks.
What's she like? Judy Dench?
Well, she wasn't on set with me. She's not in any of my scenes, but she was staying at our hotel.
Wow. Robert, the most amazing thing happened while you were away.
Really? Well, that sounds promising.
You know I told you about my sister's boyfriend in Portugal?
Of course.
Well, he showed up. At home.
Never.
He did. He wanted a private word with Dad. I thought he was going to ask if he could marry her, as if he needed permission.
Maybe in Portugal, that's how they still do it.
But it wasn't that. You won't believe it. But he came with money for Dad.
Money?
Lots of it. Remember I said about how Dad had lent some to a Portuguese man to put into that Vietnam restoration thing, and he never saw it again?
Yes.
Well, Diana has only picked up with the bloke's son. It was him with the sexy moustache. And he said that the money Dad had lent his father was invested, and it's now worth about $250,000.
Good Lord.
He brought a cheque, Dad's cashed it, and it's in his account.
Oh, that's marvellous. I bet you couldn't believe it.
Well, it's changed things a lot.
Yes, I guess so.
Dad can have his retirement flat now.
Right. So that means...
Well, if you wanted to, you, that is to say, we, could... Well, only if you still want to.
Oh, I still want to.
No, don't worry, Di. We're not going for a few minutes yet. Yeah, cheers. Diana will be here any second, she says. Apparently she's had a lovely week dad-sitting, and now she's looking forward to a fortnight's dog-sitting for us.
Oh, I'm not sure Eva will have been very relaxing for her.
As long as it keeps her mind off the divorce, I don't care. Do you want a hand closing that? Do you want me to sit on it?
Thanks. Don't seem like a year since the last Bond movie, and here we go again.
It's been a good year.
It's been busy. What with work, getting your dad installed in his new place, us moving here.
Sorting out the garden?
Yes, well, we'll make a start on that when we get back. Honest. Now, have you got your toothpaste?
Yes, of course I have. Have you got the visas?
They're in the top drawer.
In your bedside cabinet?
Uh-huh.
Had you forgotten them?
Not likely.
Are you sure? Oh, yes, here they are. Oh, Robert? What's this?
Oh, that.
It's a false moustache. A big, bushy black moustache. Robert?
Well, yeah, that was for a part some time ago. Is my passport there as well?
Never mind your passport. I recognise this moustache.
Oh.
That Thursday, you were supposed to ring me from Lanzarote, you remember? Where were you?
Lanzarote?
Really? Not on a flight to Heathrow? A flying visit, perhaps, to see my dad?
Well, maybe.
The moustache, the fake tan. Your accent was very convincing. Fooled me.
Well, I am supposed to be an actor. Fidelia... I had to make up a story. He wouldn't accept a gift.
No, he never would have.
So, no harm done?
No. No harm.
Taxi for Mr. and Mrs. Kelpie.
Coming!
In How White the Lie, you heard Michael Dyer as Patrick Noble, Alison Reeves as Fidelia, and Nigel Buckley as Robert. How White the Lie was produced and directed in our studio here by John Plush. It's just time to give you the answers to our mating call quiz. Number one is the mating cry of an orangutan in Indonesia. While this is a fox just down the road from here. That was a peacock, and this an alligator. And finally, an elk. And that's it for this month. Our grateful thanks to Carol Hartle and her team for administration, to David and Sylvia Day for copying, and to you for listening. So, it's goodbye from Christine.
Goodbye.
From Evelyn.
Goodbye.
From Barney.
Goodbye.
And from me, Stephen. Goodbye.